conducted on behalf of the Oral History Program of Century High School. The interviewee is Julie McLeod. The interviewer is Lindsay Spencer. The interview took place at Thursday, May 19th at 2 o'clock. Tell them how you live in Hillsboro.
I've lived in Hillsboro probably about 23 years.
What is it that you exactly do with this school?
Well, I work for the Washington County Sheriff's Office, and my assignment is crime prevention, and I do a lot of community education about teaching the people how to avoid becoming victims of crime, things they can do to improve home security or their personal safety. Right now I'm working on a big project about methamphetamine. I work a lot too on domestic violence awareness and various other topics.
How long have you done that for?
I've worked for the Sheriff's Office for almost 4 years. Prior to that, I also worked for the Hillsboro Police Department in crime prevention and also as a police officer.
Okay. What do you believe is the biggest problem in Hillsboro?
Well, I think probably as far as criminal activity goes, I would say methamphetamine is certainly a big problem, not just because of the crime that it generates, but also the way that it tears apart families and is creating a public health crisis in our community. I also think that a lot of issues related to young people, say getting involved in violence or youth gangs, is also a big problem that we need to address.
How long have you, so you're in the Sheriff's Department for 4 years, so how long have you been doing police force?
I've worked in law enforcement in one way or another for, I would say, 12 years.
So since then, have you seen, has the problems that we've been having changing? I know that meth has become really big right now, but how has that changed over the years?
Well, I think that probably young people are using drugs at an earlier age than they used to. Every year it seems to go, to a lower and lower age group. I think that there's a lot more instability with families than there was 10, 20 years ago, and that also has an effect on young people getting involved in drugs and crime.
How often do you deal with criminals?
I, in my current assignment, don't deal with criminals much at all, although I did interview some for a meth video project that we recently completed. One young woman in particular, we interviewed back in December in Pocky Creek Prison, right when she was getting ready to get out, and she had been through treatment and rehab and was doing really well, but she recently, a few weeks ago, committed some more crimes, kind of at the same time she was working with me. So she wasn't committing a crime in my presence, but apparently she was involved in drugs and some crimes during the course of my working with her.
Do you think that people that use drugs are more, do you see a relation between criminal activities and drug users? Do you think more drug users are committing crimes than...
Yes, I think that a lot of the crime committed in Washington County is fueled by drugs. Whether it's stealing people's cars or their identity or their mail or just plain neglecting their children. I don't think that all drug addicts are necessarily criminals. They may do criminal acts. I think that certainly if they're dealing or making drugs, they're criminals. But there's a lot of people that are just stuck in addiction that also get caught up in crime, not ever waking up thinking, I'm going to become a criminal and go to prison.
How do you feel about the law enforcement?
I think that, I can speak to law enforcement in Hillsboro as a citizen of Hillsboro, and I think that they're doing a pretty good job. I think that right now there's a pretty big problem with gang activity that the police and the school district and the juvenile department are trying to address. I think that law enforcement in Washington County in general does a very good job with the resources they have, trying to keep the community safe and also react to the needs of people. They try to gauge the expectations of the community and react accordingly. I think that probably people expect too much from the police. I think that citizens in general expect the police to solve a lot of problems that are more society's problems, especially if you look at, say, families that are at risk, maybe single-parent families, parent is working, two jobs and isn't at home in the evening to keep an eye on what the kids are doing, and then they kind of run amok.
Yeah.
And though that is that a police, is that a law enforcement problem when those kids commit crimes, or they make a nuisance of themselves in the neighborhood, or is that a society problem that parents are forced to work so much to be away from their families when they should be nurturing them?
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. How do you, as a citizen, how do you feel? Do you feel safe? Do you feel, like Shannon says, do you feel that she's safe at school? And
I think that I feel somewhat jaded, perhaps, having worked in law enforcement for a while, knowing that, there are a lot of dangerous things out there, and I'm always worried about my kids, but I think generally I do feel confident that they're safe at school, and that she would know what to do if some emergency happened. But it's a worry all the time. I think all parents do dread whenever their kids are away from them, something bad could happen.
Do you think that do you feel safer knowing, being at the police and knowing what the dangers are? Do you feel that you've been able to, educate your children more?
Well, I've tried, and I'll tell you, we kind of go back and forth because they've always accused me of being paranoid. And I tell them that I know what's out there and they don't, that they're naive, and so we kind of go back and forth with that. But, ultimately, I try to equip them to be safe in the community and to know what to do if an emergency occurs. But I think that they would do okay.
Do you feel safer now than you did when you first moved here 23 years ago?
That's a good question. I probably would say I do feel safer, but it's more that I have more confidence in my ability to keep myself safe and depend on the police to do that. Because let's face it, if you have 1.5 officers per 1,000 of the population, or whatever the magic number is, that's not very many cops.
No.
And they're most likely not going to be there if you are, being a victim of crime, being attacked, or having stuff stolen. So you really have to have a plan in your mind and know what you will do. And I think that it's important to try to encourage and inspire people to get involved in their community, not necessarily become a cop, but what can I do to help families and young people?
Okay. What ethnic group do you believe is involved in crime in Hillsborough today?
I think that probably all ethnic groups are involved in crime. I don't think that you can really say one group or another is more prone to crime. I think that it's just a matter of their personality combined with the environment they grow up in and what they think is their moral code. So I would be hesitant to say that any one race or group of people is more involved in crime. Not knowing if statistics support that or not. That's just gut reaction to the question. I think that if we we do try to single out a particular race or ethnic group, it could be very hurtful to that group. And so I would be very hesitant to make those kind of general broad.
What do you believe is the biggest cause of crime in the whole state?
Well, I guess that depends on the type of crime. Probably people associated with fraud and theft, like, you know, property crimes that don't hurt people, is probably more fueled by drugs. I think probably person crimes, where people are, you know, acting out violently against one another, it's more, they're doing that more because of their environment. Say maybe they're in a home with domestic violence, or here's a huge thing. In my opinion, about the cause of violence is just the media violence that young people and everybody in our society is subjected to.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, whether it's television or music or video games, video games are a huge contributor to acts of violent aggression. And, you know, I'm not just saying that's my opinion, that statistics will bear me out there. So I think that if you're looking at violent crime, then their environment plus, you know, their family environment plus, you know, what they're putting into their mind, whether it be video games or violent music, and that is a big contributor.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me, like, what domestic violence is considered to be?
Well, a lot of people probably think domestic violence is, you know, the classic, the husband slapping the wife around. But it's all about power and control. And the person who's wanting to control the other person in the relationship, whether it be, you know, an intimate partner or even a parent and a child, that person uses violence to control the other person. So anytime that there's verbal abuse or physical abuse or sexual abuse directed at someone to manipulate their behavior and make them do whatever the batterer wants them to do, then it would be considered domestic violence. Are we going to arrest somebody because they're yelling at their loved one and you know, damaging their self-esteem? No. But, you know, if they're shoving them around and, you know, hitting them, and putting marks on them, you know, strangling them, that kind of thing, then definitely they would be arrested for the crime of domestic violence.
When you arrest them, how long are they usually, like, do most women press charges, or most victims press charges, and if they do, how long are they held for?
When somebody is arrested for domestic violence, let's say this, a police officer is called to the scene of a domestic dispute, and they determine that someone has been injured, that there's evidence of an injury, then police officers are mandated by law to arrest the aggressor. If the person has inflicted injuries on someone else to defend themselves, then they're not going to get arrested for domestic violence. But if it's someone who's aggressively, you know, attacking someone else and their injuries, and they're going to jail. Once they get to jail, they're generally going to stay there until they go in front of the judge, whether it's the next day or if it's over the weekend, whether it's on a Monday, and then the judge gives conditions of their release pending their court date, their trial, if you will. And so they are almost always going to say you cannot have contact with the victim. And then they can, if they have money, they can post bail and they can be out walking around. Not every time someone is arrested are they actually going to be charged by the district attorney and go through the court process, because the district attorney has to decide, is there enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they did this. So they may not charge the person, so they may get off, basically. Now, because of the Supreme Court decision that was made several months ago, the victim has to appear in court if they want to go forward. So even, you know, they may call the police, the perpetrator gets arrested, but if they're not willing to come to court and testify, then the case can't proceed, because the Supreme Court determined that any person who's being accused of a crime has the right to face their accuser in court, whereas before, it could just be, if the person gave their statement in an excited, upset state, they call it an excited utterance, that it just happened, they're crying, they're upset, you know, we have a tape of the 911 call that, you know, where they're crying and obviously have been victimized, or they tell a police officer that they were, then that was good enough. Mm-hmm. But now they can't do that, even with photographs and those types of statements. So I would say that a lot of times the victims don't want to participate, shall we say. Sometimes people say they don't want to cooperate in the process, but I think that if they don't cooperate, they have reasons, and maybe those reasons are just for their own safety, that they know if they push forward with this, then they could get killed. Yeah. So I like to say they don't want to participate, and it's not so, you know, blaming them. But a lot of times they don't want to participate just because they don't think it's a safe thing for them to do. But if they don't, then here's a way that things have changed since 1980. There's a lot more resources and support for victims out in the community, especially in Washington County. We have the Domestic Violence Resource Center working closely with the Center for Victim Services and police agencies like Hillsborough Police that have domestic violence advocates and specialized detectives that work these cases, and so there's a lot more effort made to make things easier for victims to get help. And whether they're able to leave their abuser or not, that's probably not as important as having them have a safety plan, like knowing what to do if, you know, they are in a violent confrontation and how to get out of there and stay safe. They do also have the option of filing a restraining order against the perpetrator. And just recently in Washington County, they totally reinvented that whole process to make it more user-friendly. There's a new form that's easier to read and understand. And a lot of people worked on that, putting it together. Police, judges, district attorneys, victim advocates, even defense attorneys who would be defending the batterers had input on how it was put together. And so I think there's a huge effort that's just continued to gain momentum over the last 10 or 15 years that wants to help victims, wants to help families cope and then heal from being in a violent home situation.
That's what we read a newspaper article from the 1980s, and there was a refuge for women, and they only could accept 5 women and their children.
And I think it's better than that, but there's not a lot more beds than that for people that need to get away. A lot of people probably go to family members or, you know, try to move out of the area, but if we had more shelters, we could certainly fill them. And people do complain that we have more shelters for animals than we do for families and domestic violence situations.
Who do you think the average, or statistically, or the average victim is? Is it a woman, or how is that changed?
In domestic violence,
yeah,
you mean?
Violence.
I think that probably statistics are somewhere in the 90s, 90% of, you know, females being victims and males being the perpetrator. But more and more, not so much women are. Women can certainly be the aggressor, but I think more and more too, law enforcement is having to judge when we have same-sex couples, and so you can't just have that stereotype in your mind that, you know, it's the guy's fault, because if you have two guys and, you know, maybe both of them have injuries, you have to try to figure out which one is the aggressor. And so then you have to ask a lot more questions and interview neighbors and try to get some kind of history to find out, you know, is there a pattern of abuse here, and who is the aggressor and who's trying to defend themselves. So that's more of an issue that law enforcement has had to address in recent years. Mm-hmm. And when there are male victims of domestic violence, there's hardly any services for them because, you know, shelters are for women. And most of the therapy that they would send batterers to is you know, for males. So if you're a female batterer and the judge orders you to go to some kind of battery intervention treatment, you know, it's probably going to be a little harder to find.
Yeah.
But I think, too, that we're becoming more aware that these kind of violent relationships are forming with young people in their dating years, even. And I have a real concern about teenage girls in relationships with controlling and manipulative and violent partners. And it kind of becomes a way of life. And those guys, and the statistics do bear out, too, that young boys who witness domestic violence in their home are more likely to become violent toward women, and girls who witness it are more likely to accept that from their male partners. So the kids of these families are just at a real risk of either becoming perpetrators or victims themselves. Mm. So that's a huge thing that, you know, we as a society need to address.
So since 1980, you said that, you know, now you have the problem with same-sex couples with their abuse and more men. Like, how has the numbers or the statistics changed? Like, then, you know, stereotypically it was mostly women that were abused, so now has it changed?
Well, I don't know if the statistics have necessarily changed, but I think we're becoming more aware that this is an issue, and we are becoming more aware that it's going on, but it's not being reported, because it's not really... not culturally acceptable for a guy to say some woman beat the crap out of him, you know. Or a lot of people that are same-sex relationships, they don't really want everyone to know about their orientation, so they don't report it. But whether statistics bear that out or not, I don't know. It's more anecdotally, but I know that from talking with people that work in the domestic violence social work area. So don't really have statistics.
Yeah, but we become more aware.
Yeah, I would say. And who knows if it was happening just as much 20 years ago, but probably was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way law enforcement has responded to domestic violence situations has radically changed in 20 years because, you know, it's just the classic story in the 80s where a cop would be called to some kind of domestic dispute and he would try to talk to the people and tell them to stop fighting, and the next time he comes back, or she comes back, somebody's going to jail.
Yeah.
And there was discretion on the police officer's part whether they would arrest him or not. And if they just thought, you know, giving these two people a talking to would get them to settle down and cool off and stop fighting, then that's great. But since we established some laws that require police officers to make an arrest at the scene of a violent domestic dispute, then it's taken that challenge for them to have to figure it out away, or it's taken their discretion away. So they just automatically have to arrest if they have probable cause.
Right. What is it like to be a woman in a job that's predominantly male? Or at least, you know,
Yeah. Well, I think that it's interesting. It can be challenging because you kind of have this male brotherhood attitude sometimes. It's a little bit annoying. Sometimes the men don't respect the women or think that they can hold up their end of the fight if, you know, that's what it comes to. But I think that there are a lot of women in law enforcement that have been in law enforcement for some time that kind of paved the way to prove that women can be good cops. Are they going to do things exactly the way that a guy would? Probably not. Women are probably going to try to talk and reason with people a little more than going hands-on in some kind of conflict with a criminal, as long as they can, just because that's kind of how we are.
Yeah.
Guys are more ready to bring it on physically if they get challenged. But I think that men and women certainly complement each other in law enforcement, that men have strengths and women have strengths, and if we can agree that we'll partner up, you know, we can be an awesome team. I think that definitely it's better for women in law enforcement than it was 20 years ago. I recently worked with a woman, who recently retired from the sheriff's office, Sergeant William Gaskins, who had been a police officer since maybe the mid-70s. And she was not accepted at all at the sheriff's office when she first started doing that job. You know, guys wouldn't back her up on calls, and they wouldn't associate with her, socialize with her, and it was very, very hard. But, you know, she hung in there, and she proved that she could do a good job, and she could scrap with the best of them, and she earned their respect. And I think by doing that, she really paved the way for a lot of other women who came after her to be accepted and as equal partners. In my role now in crime prevention, I'm more of a support service for the patrol officers. We do, the patrol deputies, we do have several female deputies, though, that are working with, that are doing an excellent job. So I think it just depends on your personality, and it's not so much whether you're male or female, I think people are realizing, but do you have the ability to, you know, be tough and make pretty split-second decisions sometimes, while at the same time being understanding and kind and helpful in the situations that you need to be like that. You have to really be able to change how you approach people based on what they present to you. You know, if they're being violent and you need to take control and they won't comply, then you have to, you know, meet that violence. But if it's some little child that's, you know, just been victimized in some way, you need to be able to get down on one knee and comfort that child and try to help them and not scare them. So that it's a, you know, pretty wide range of skills that a police officer needs to have to be successful. But all the agencies that I know in Washington County are pretty good at training people to meet those challenges. They put a lot of time and effort into training and giving them good equipment and making sure that they pick the right people. That might be another area, in not necessarily crime, how crime has changed, but how law enforcement has changed in 20 years, is that, you know, we're a lot pickier about who we choose to be cops today than we used to, because they have to pass really pretty rigorous psychological testing to make sure that they're mentally capable of doing the job.
And they didn't used to have to, it's a lot easier to be a cop.
Yeah,
what else has changed? Do you think they train people more?
Yeah, I think they train people a lot better than they used to. Part of that is because of liability. There's a realization that if you're sending cops out to, you know, drive fast and have the ability to take away people's freedom and use deadly force, that you need to make sure that they're trained on how to do that, you know, at the highest skill level that they can possibly have. And so there's a lot of training that's been implemented in the last several years that was never there before. And two, there are a lot more high-tech tools that cops need to be able to use, you know, whether it's an automatic rifle, or whether it's a taser or spike strips, or, you know, just operating a police vehicle at a high rate of speed. There's just a lot of things that could go wrong, so you need to train and train and train some more so you can handle any situation. Because it would really be negligent if, you know, we sent cops out on the street and they weren't proficient in all those tools.
Right. what when you said you now teach prevention, mm-hmm. and what exactly are you doing?
Well, kind of a wide variety of things, really. I teach neighborhood groups how to form a neighborhood watch and how to look out for one another, how to recognize suspicious activity, how to report it, how to communicate effectively with the police if they have an issue or a problem. Teach them too about, like I said before, home security, things they can do to make their home safer and less attractive to burglars and harder to break into. I teach adults and young people alike about personal safety, just tips when you're out in public, staying safe, staying aware of your surroundings, being prepared ahead of time. There's several programs that we provide on request to groups, and we can teach about identity theft, how to avoid becoming a victim of that, some tips to protect your identity. We teach a class to parents and school personnel on recognizing child molesters to help keep little kids safe from sexual predators. Because in the past we realized that we tried to teach kids to protect themselves, but really that's not fair because they're not really they're not sophisticated enough to recognize when a pedophile is grooming them. Like, they just see somebody who cares about them and, you know, gives them gifts and makes them feel special, and they have no idea that this person that they're starting to trust and really love has any bad motives in mind. Mm-hmm. So it's up to the parents to recognize those people and their behaviors so they can keep them away from their child and then report them to police if they do suspect something. Like I said, I'm doing a lot of training on methamphetamine, making people aware not just about what are the signs of the meth lab in your neighborhood, but also, you know, what are some signs in, you know, your children that might indicate that they're using it, or what are some preventive things that families and communities can do to keep kids out of drug abuse, or even prevent them from ever trying, particularly meth, and how it all needs to tie together with law enforcement and prevention, education, and also treatment, and spending money as a government or as a community to get people the treatment they need so they can get off of it and go back to being successful members of society. So, kind of a variety of stuff.
Do you think the police have become more involved with educating people about that kind of stuff from 20 years ago, you know, like trying to make people more aware?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that 20 years ago, cops were more of the attitude like, call us and we'll handle it, we'll fix it, we'll take care of it. And that really wasn't because as we realized when community policing started becoming popular, we really need the community to be involved in doing what they can do, like, you know, doing these, making these habits of locking their doors and calling, you know, to report suspicious activity and all the things that I teach people to do. Now that's their role, and also investing time and energy in helping kids grow up safe and nurtured and cared for. So I think that over the last 20 years, police have definitely figured that out, that we need to engage the community more, that we can't fix everything just by arresting people and throwing them in jail. And right now, with the economy the way it is, the budget situation, at least in Washington County, there's a huge issue with not being able to keep criminals in jail that deserve to be there. So every day they have to decide which person who is brought in by the police is least likely to recommit a crime or be a danger to society that we can let out, because we have all these other ones, you know, being brought in. So it's kind of a revolving door for some of these people. So I think definitely in that regard, knowing that jail's not the answer, we have to work more collaboratively with schools and with the business community and with social workers and the district attorney's office and everybody, you know, the faith community, and trying to get people to just volunteer, care about their community, and take some kind of action to make Hillsborough better.
Do you think that, you know, how people are always like, oh, well, I lock my doors now and I never used to have to. Do you think it's not so much that there's more criminal activity, but just that people are becoming more aware that, you know, it can happen and you should try and prevent it from happening?
Well, I think it could be both, Lindsay. I think there probably is more criminal activity, and the people that are getting victimized are telling other people, hey, this happened because I didn't lock my door, so you might want to remember to lock yours up. And, you know, I have relatives in the Midwest, and they still, to this day, don't lock their doors. And maybe they don't need to, but eventually, you know, there's a good chance they could be victimized. Because a lot of criminals aren't that smart. They're just taking advantage of an opportunity. So they may go around a neighborhood some morning when everybody's off to school and work and just try doorknobs. And the first one that opens, because someone forgot to lock it, then they're going to go in and grab as much as they can and get out of there. They'll go to the pawn shop, get what they can, and go buy drugs. I mean, that's kind of the classic scenario. So I think that as much as we can encourage people to have habits where they lock stuff up, they put their valuables where people can't see them, they take note of who's in their space when they're walking down the street, so if somebody, you know, starting to come close to them, they can be ready to react and, you know, run away if they need to, rather than, you know, wait to be mugged.
Right. We got the Hillsborough Arguses from the 1980s, and we've been looking at them, and a lot of the crimes that were in there were along the steps. How have you seen that change over the years? Like, it's still down by a lot of thefts, and it changed, you know, doing more drug things or more, you know, murders, or how is...
I think it's probably still, thefts are probably the highest on the list of crimes, you know, whether it's people getting their mail stolen, or their car, or their stuff, you know, from their purse, you know, they left in, you know, on the counter somewhere when they were shopping, and then they came back and it was gone. I think it's still a lot of theft.
Is there anything else that we should know about?
How much time do we have?
I have all the time we have.
I can't really think of anything major that we haven't covered. Maybe one other thing that's different. That now, as opposed to 20 years ago, we have police officers working in schools. We have DARE officers that are teaching little kids to resist drugs and gangs at the elementary level. And we have, you know, school resource officers that are making their presence known at schools and, you know, serving as security. I think they are a deterrent to some things that might go on at school, although I still think there's a fair amount of crime that occurs at school that the community doesn't realize. I used to work at Glenpool High School, and I know that, you know, kids left their backpacks unattended any length of time, you know, pretty soon they come back and their calculator's gone, their CD player's gone. Big, you know, their cars are broken into, their stairs are stolen. I think that there's a lot of crime that still occurs at school, even with police officers. And I'm not sure how we counteract that. But is that a society problem where people are just losing their moral code and thinking it's okay to steal what people don't have secured? Or is it somebody that's wanting to use it to buy drugs? I don't know. But definitely I think that, you know, there's a moral issue there that a lot of people speculate, are people just more evil in general than they were 20 years ago?
Yeah.
And why would that be? So, I don't know.
How long have police been in school?
Well, I don't think it's been much more than 10 years. Yeah.
Do you think it's made a difference?
I think it has. I think it's helped young people to realize that police are people too, mm-hmm. and that they care about them. And I think it helps parents feel a little more comfortable that their child is safer at school. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. Because, you know, in Hillsborough, it would be nice to have one cop at school all day, every day, but, you know, there's not enough to be able to do that. So there's going to be times when some of these buildings, times when they won't. So I think in general, though, if the police are on scene and people do feel safer. I want to talk a little bit, if it's okay, about the media violence,
mm-hmm.
because I recently went to a training put on by a guy who's kind of an expert in the field, and he was saying that since the advent of television, there's been a steady increase in violent aggression toward, you know, other people, and that kind of is correlates with the number of people that get incarcerated in prison for violent assaults. But at the same time, you have like the death rate from murders has stayed fairly low. And he attributes that to just medical science being able to save people that, you know, get shot, and whereas 20 years ago they would have been dead, but now they go to trauma center and they're good to go. Wow. But it's been pretty amazing that since the advent of television and all of the violent images that go into our brains from a young age, that it does have an effect. And what it does is it desensitizes us to the act, the aggression, or even the act of killing. Because he has studied this in depth to find out that all human beings have this built-in phobia against killing other human beings. And they've studied this for the purpose of training soldiers, because they found in World War II a lot of soldiers are just firing their guns over the heads of the enemy instead of actually trying to kill them. And so then they started training them to fire, instead of at targets, the bullseyes, to actually fire at silhouettes of human beings. And that sort of helped them focus more on the enemy than, you know, just firing over their head. And then as time has gone on, now they have these really sophisticated virtual reality type training things where, you know, even in firearms training for cops, you know, you have these computer generated scenarios that are shoot or don't shoot, that it's not just plinking away at a target,
mm-hmm.
it's actually, you know, having to make a decision on whether to kill or not kill. And that's effective if you want to train people to go to war and kill, or to be a police officer and have to use deadly force. But what's happening is that kids that are pretty heavy users of video games, that where you're, you know, killing is the goal,
mm-hmm.
and you get rewarded for killing and doing other horrible stuff, that you are desensitizing their brains in the same way that they do to prepare people to go to war. And it's just this fascinating theory, and it really is more than a theory, that they've been able to prove how those violent images that go in your visual sense, how it doesn't go through your cerebral cortex that processes information. It goes straight to your fight or flight kind of primitive brain. I don't know if this is anything that you care about or are interested in, but I think that was pretty pretty amazing and profound if we think about that and how our society is becoming more violent, and that could be a reason, the big reason why.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's a really fascinating, and there have been some studies done by these researchers that show if we can get kids to turn off the TV for at least 10 days and they kind of detoxify from its effects or whatever, then they're more likely to not be so violent at school. I brought you this little handout just for your reference if you want to take a look at it sometime. Mm-hmm. This is that chart that I talked about that shows the murder rate versus the aggravated assaults. And this